Hello, welcome to the Theology Podcast. It's great to have you here for this special episode. We're really pleased to be joined by a guest. Unfortunately, Tom's not with us today. Tom had some things that took him away, but our guest will, I'm sure, fill his chair admirably. But anyway, I'm C.R. Wiley. I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest. I've done a number of things, including teach philosophy and invest in real estate and written some books. Anyway, that's enough about me. How about you, Glenn?
I'm Glenn Sunshine, senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, ministry associate at Reflections Ministries, retired history professor, and a few other things.
And we are joined today by another professor at New St. Andrews College. Mitch, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure thing. Thanks for having me. So my name is Mitch Stokes. I'm a senior fellow of philosophy at New St. Andrews College here in Moscow, Idaho. I teach philosophy, but I also teach mathematics and physics and hermeneutics and all kinds of things, often at the same time. I used to be, before I studied philosophy, I was an engineer prior to that.
That's a fascinating combination. And actually, we're going to get into that a little bit today. For a lot of folks, they don't put together, you know, philosophy and engineering, the STEM sort of fields at all with philosophy, although that's somewhat ironic. And we were talking about that before we started rolling the camera. If we remember the Academy, what was the sign that was over the entrance? It said, if you don't know geometry, don't bother coming in.
Yeah.
Can you kind of riff on that a little bit, Mitch?
Yeah. Well, it's funny, going from engineering to philosophy, you know, I mean, particularly when I was first telling people that I was doing that and I was making that sort of career choice, you know, the blank stare, but when I explained that I was doing it because the money's better in philosophy, that made perfect sense. They're like, oh, okay.
Everybody knows that.
Yeah,
that's great. So were there blank stares on both sides? You know,
no, having the engineering background was actually an advantage for, I think, philosophy in some respects, because, you know, having that background, this sounds bad. I mean, it's easier to, I think, learn the philosophy after going through the math and physics than vice versa. And it might be just because you're energetic and it requires a lot of motivation to put yourself through some of the, you know, that kind of STEM education.
Right.
Unless you have a really, really good. So I think too, there's been a general trend, and I think I hit it at the right time, that people are seeing that this kind of siloing of disciplines is a bad thing. I mean, it's not new. I mean, you go back to like C.P. Snow has this famous.
Yeah, I was thinking about him.
Yeah. You know, bridging the two cultures kind of thing, the sciences and the humanities. I think, was that back in the 50s? Lamenting that. And so people have seen that. And even further, you look at, you know, if you start looking at, say, some of the things that, like Einstein and Heisenberg and some of those scientists, the visionaries, were saying, you can see that, wow, there's a lot of philosophy going on. And they realized it. You know, that was one of the things that they were cognizant, they were aware of.
I think about Wittgenstein, for example, and, you know, analytic philosophy, which seems to, you know, I think be maybe some common ground. You know, it's a pretty, you know, rigorous approach to philosophy. We think about someone like Alvin Plantinga, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe the more, I guess, sort of approach to philosophy is more sort of centered in the traditional humanities, maybe, is where the leap is more difficult.
Yeah, well, and it's funny, the analytic tradition, you mentioned that. I mean, that really started, you know, one of the... There are these two different strains in philosophy, and they both kind of came out of a response or a reaction to Immanuel Kant, you know, you have this continental versus analytic or whatever, and those are rough, and they're, you shouldn't be one or the other. You should kind of be somewhere in the middle. But the analytics side was actually, you know, a lot of it came out of philosophers and mathematicians like Gottlob Frege in the 1800s. So it actually came out of this rise of logic trying to philosophically understand what's going on in mathematics and look at the foundations of mathematics. Yeah. So it really is this mathematical discipline. But what's interesting, and this kind of gets back to what we were, you know, what you originally brought up, is that that's not a unique idea. That actually goes all the way back to Plato. You know, this emphasis on mathematics and using it as, or at least seeing it as important, and a kind of, you know, not just a paradigmatic example of knowledge, let's say, like, hey, look, what do we know? Well, what do we really know? Well, we know 2 + 2 = 4. Let's start with something easy. It wasn't just that. It was thinking that the world was fundamentally mathematical and there was something about the content that was important. And so I think that that analytic continental tradition, well, even some of the continental guys, I think maybe even Heidegger and some of the Husserl, you know, had mathematical backgrounds. They started out in mathematics. And so and I think people misunderstand that. They think, wow, doing math and doing philosophy have got to be the two furthest things from each other. And I think that's because we misunderstand kind of what the issues and what they meant by mathematics.
Yeah. Glenn, you were saying something?
You can actually go back before Plato. The pre-Socratics were very much into math. Pythagoras.
Right.
You know, we know him because of his geometry, but he was an incredibly important philosopher and probably the most religious of the pre-Socratics.
Yeah, you know, kind of funky dude, too.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, you can look at that. You can look at someone like... more recently, someone like, well, recently, this is the historian speaking, someone like Kepler, who is going to see a direct connection between math, the structure of the universe, and the mind of God.
Yeah.
Even earlier, someone like Bacon, Roger Bacon, that is, not Francis, Roger Bacon, or just before him, Robert Grosseteste, believed that mathematics was the language of science. What we would call science, they would have said natural philosophy. Right. So there, and again, natural philosophy. Right. So this connection has been there and really only started dividing in the 19th century.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder, you mentioned Pythagoras. That's what, you know, as far as we can tell, that's Plato. You know, we typically think that Plato was, you know, Socrates is his teacher, and that's true and in an important sense. But he was also trained by these Pythagoreans, and so much of his main, some of his main ideas, everything from, you know, his idea of the soul and the mathematical cause, all of that, so much comes from Pythagoras. And like you say, it's a shame that we kind of know Pythagoras just as the Pythagorean theorem, when it really is kind of, Plato was this card-carrying Pythagorean, and, you know, in the Republic, he's explicit about that. And in the Timaeus, you know, I mean, it's all this Pythagorean idea. And so it really is at the very foundation of Western philosophy.
Yeah. When you think about Pythagoras, you know, I think of a, you know, this kind of funky mystic, but I also think about this guy who really had a genuine insight into the nature of reality. He has a kind of a tinfoil hat kind of personality, though, because he sees all these these correspondences.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And that's one of the things that we in one of the classes I teach at NSA is that we kind of try to highlight that because, you know, insofar as we know about Pythagoras, we certainly know about Pythagoreans and what they thought and how, you know, some of it just sounds loony. You know, you're thinking, okay, exactly, where's the tinfoil hat? And you go, okay, wait a second, this guy has both these amazing insights that end up becoming so foundational to the West and to physics, contemporary, I mean, and yet he's also kind of wild. And I want the students to see, okay, tell me where that dividing line is between crazy, you know, and genius and insightful. And sometimes that's not clear. And I'll show them something like a, we just went through this. There was a discovery in the 60s. The guy, Murray Gell-Mann, a physicist, he came up with the idea of quarks. One of the people that came up with the idea of quarks got a Nobel Prize for it. But he makes this discovery of a new particle by looking at kind of these symmetries that end up, you can actually draw them out. And it looks like, if you've seen the Pythagorean tetractys that has these, it's like 10 dots and, you know, a triangle with four dots on each side. And it ends up, and it's very central to Pythagoreanism. And it turns out that Gell-Mann, I don't know if he knew this, he's using the tetractys to find this new particle. And you go, okay, that doesn't seem very scientific.
Yeah,
you know, and obviously he wasn't just divining it, and he didn't have a, you know, he had mathematics and all of that going behind it. But that doesn't, just because there's mathematics behind it, we tend to think, oh, well, that legitimizes it and makes it a scientific and not crazy. There's magic going on there, you know, it's really amazing.
Well, you think about, is it Newton who was into alchemy? I mean, and he's like, you know, and then writing commentaries on the book Revelation and doing all kinds of stuff.
And you can go back to Copernicus, who was a committed Pythagorean Christian, and Kepler, who was really the last great Pythagorean. I mean, you know, all of the early scientists are influenced by this. This is really shaping how they think.
And like you say, they're explicit about it. You know, Kepler is like, hey, look, you know, I mean, and then, you know, the Copernican view, you know, even Galileo talks about that. They called it the Pythagorean view sometimes, you know. I mean, so, yeah, you're right. I mean, there is funny, one thing, I think Heisenberg actually, he mentioned somewhere that, I don't know if he mentions Pythagoreanism, but he mentions Platonism. He says, yeah, history has basically voted in favor of Plato. You know, mathematics and the world of the subatomic realm are basically just forms.
Well, that's it. You know, I have a friend who teaches mathematics at Wheaton College, and just we had dinner one day and I said, you know, what is it? Are you Platonist? He says, of course. You know, it's just we're dealing with fundamental structures of reality. Either this is all a human construct, or we really have a genuine insight into the fundamental structure of reality. And it's pretty weird to maintain that mathematics is just a coincidence, that the things that we do with mathematics just has this coincidental relationship to the physical world.
You know? Right, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and yet you need to take it a step further. It's not just the physical world. It's the structure of the human mind as well. We're not just dealing with, you know, E=mc², mathematics, science, that kind of thing, where it actually has an important effect on the structure of human consciousness as well, even though we don't normally think of it that way.
That's interesting. Consciousness is something that I know very little about, but can you say more about that? How the math or the Platonism is related to the consciousness?
Well, first of all, as a Christian Platonist, I'm going to have to go there. but along with that, you know, mathematics is a product of the human, in its simplest terms, simplest way of illustrating this, is mathematics is a product of the human mind. You know, we develop mathematics and then suddenly discover that actually this stuff is the way the world really works.
That
there's a connection between the way the mind works and the way the universe works.
Right.
And the intermediary is mathematics.
Yeah.
Isn't the illustration that Plato uses in the Meno a mathematical illustration of like recollection? You know, remember he brings up the slave boy, asks him a series of leading questions, geometric questions, and all the kid knows is yes, no, you know, and then, you know, Plato says, well, there you go. Oh, actually, it's Socrates, of course, in the dialogue, but Socrates said, there you go. He knows it, you know, even though he's an uneducated slave boy, he gets it. So in other words, there's a sense in which we're kind of born with the cheat sheet. You know, remember the back of the book when you were in high school, you know, you'd see all the answers to the quizzes in the front of the book and they're all in the back. There's a sense in which it's all kind of in there. And this is where things get really freaky. You know, this is where people think of it start, you know, well, Plato did this, you know, he speculated about reincarnation, you know, is that the way it works? But there's kind of an infinite regress. Somewhere you got to start, you know, and And I think that the Christian proposition that we're made in the image of God gets at the core of that. There's some sense in which, you know, our you know, the logos is somehow inhabiting us. It reflects the larger cosmos. Yeah.
And I think, you know, going back to connecting what both of you are saying, like with Kepler, this notion of how the mind, you know, there's a connection between the mind and the cosmos, you know, and maybe someone can give an evolutionary story.
I have not been able to find anybody who can.
But that connection is something that is, we tend to take for granted, and it's really absolutely remarkable. And this notion of, the mind, like even someone like Roger Penrose, who's this mathematician at Oxford, you know, has this kind of, you know, cosmos, mind, Platonistic world, you know, he's a Platonist. And so it's like, they're connected.
Yeah. I remember it was a Nagel, Mind and Cosmos, that book came out a few years ago. Now, you know, this drove Pythagoras in the direction of mysticism, right? You know, he's kind of this mystical mathematician, which is funky to think about.
Yeah.
No, I think that
you know something about medieval occult theories, which case mathematical mysticism makes perfect sense.
But I think that though, for the popular mind though today, I think we're more sort of, our expectations have been formed by positivism. You know, this idea we're just dealing with, material reality when we're talking about math. Sometimes you run across people who make an important distinction between qualitative and quantitative reasoning. The qualitative, it has to do with value, axiology. The quantitative has to do with surfaces, things that can be measured, extension, you know, that kind of stuff. You have any thoughts on that? How maybe that's a good way to approach things, not a good way to think about it? I mean, it seems as though it feeds into Snow's two culture thing.
Yeah. No, I think going back to what Glenn was saying, Chris, on the one hand, I think it is surprising that there's this connection between mathematics and mysticism. And then Glenn, I think on the other hand, it's like, well, looking at the history, you see that it's not surprising at all, you know, going back to, and I think you start seeing that with, wasn't just starting with Einstein. You have Maxwell, you know, was very much, you know, he wrote poetry and was all, but his idea that he's this Christian who, God designed all this, and I'm looking at the mathematical world and there's this connection, and he waxed eloquently about it all. And, but then you do have this kind of the difference between like kind of mysticism versus a Christianity. I mean, I know there's Christian mysticism, but what, if you don't have that idea of a divine designer probably behind, you've got to have some explanation. And that does lead people, I think, automatically to start like, something's going on here. It's more than meets the eye. And then you start, and then you have people that are taking, you know, you have like the Tao of physics, you know, or something like that, that, you know, a lot of mainstream physicists just go, oh my gosh, that's terrible. I mean, but bringing in this kind of Eastern mysticism that even Bohr had, you know, this like both and yin and yang, but weird stuff is going on, and it's not just at like a surfacey level, it's ultimate reality for them. You know, this, what everything's made out of is bizarre and kind of this one hand clapping sort of thing for them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you kind of, I think it's natural for people to, you got to have some answer.
Yeah. I've heard, you know, quantum physics described as sort of making room for free will in a way that maybe the mechanistic approach that preceded it didn't seem to have space for. And then also the idea that reality as we experience is almost perpetually, sort of the universe or the cosmos emerging out of nothing kind of on an ongoing basis. There's this kind of, I think it was Nate Wilson who talked in those terms one time, and I wasn't really taken by it. Of course, I'm not a scientist, and I'm assuming that Nate isn't either. But there is this sort of mysterious sort of sub, you know, this world of subatomic particles that just doesn't seem to behave at all like the commonsensical observed world that we live in, which seems to open up kind of this space for, you know, mystical ways of thinking.
Yeah. And I, and just knowing that the world is a lot spookier. And so I think it does create space for all this spookiness, however it gets filled. But for someone to say, well, yeah, I don't think that, I don't think that God would do X. Like you kind of, now it's kind of hard to, I mean, I totally get it. And I totally get where some people are coming from, but there's also an aspect of, I don't know, I'd be really careful about saying what God can do or what he would or wouldn't do. Cause I don't even know what an electron is, you know? I mean, so in that sense, it's not that I'm saying that there's an argument for God because it's a mystery. I'm just saying we should probably, I think there should be a humility of, you know, I'm really not sure what it is going on. Like, and I think that's helped me a lot as a Christian when I, you know, think about, well, how, you know, I have all kinds of questions too. Like, you know, how I'm praying to God, how does he know my thoughts? You know, what does that mean? You know, they talk about consciousness and mental entities, and how does he, you know, there's a, what's his relationship to time? If I'm praying to him, how does he's hearing me, but he's hearing all these other people at the same time. And I have, you know, I mean, from questions like that to all, how do you make sense of this, that, or the other? I do find that the more I learn about physics and the way the world seems to be working, it's made me kind of cool my jets on some of those. It's helped me at least have a little bit of patience with those and just go, okay.
Like we necessarily have to be satisfied with a kind of provisional knowledge, because, you know, just take a look at the recent discoveries that this space telescope has, brought to us. You know, we were pretty confident, you know, just before these photographs came in, that we understood things. I think we're going to have to rework all the textbooks now. But that just keeps happening over the course of my life. That's happened, you know, a dozen times. And so, you know, it doesn't shake my faith in the value of the scientific enterprise, but it does certainly qualify in my mind any given set of findings at any given time. There's something that, you know, you don't know what you don't know. In other words, we don't have all the data, and is it even conceivable that we ever would?
Right. Yeah. And that's certainly the case. For me, even the stuff that we seem to know, it's not going to get any, I would imagine, I don't know this, it seems like it's not going to get any less crazy. You know, the more we discover about the universe, it's probably not going to get, we're probably going to be more and more surprised, but it's at least this surprising and bizarre. And so if the something like, you know, desks or tables, what's going on and making them possible is so bizarre that it's hard to really, you know, it's like, it's not just mostly space. There's a sense in which if these things are infinitely small and the mass is what, you know, we get, mass is generated from energy, like it's almost all space, you know, it's like, it seems like it's a magical world. And you go, okay, at the very least, if tables are this complicated and hard to, why am I surprised that God is, I don't understand what God's plan is sometimes.
Yeah. It takes me back to Buckaroo Banzai back in the 80s. And I remember, you know, if you remember that film.
I remember the movie. I never saw it, but I remember the title.
And the Eighth Dimension. That was basically the premise of the film, is that we're surrounded by things that appear to be solid, but are actually hardly there. And, you know, then there are creatures moving between dimensions. Yeah, it's fun. You'd enjoy it. It's pretty bizarre as well, you know. Yes. getting to kind of the prejudices that we have, it's just, you know, when we think about conventional wisdom in society, it's almost as though it's stuck in like the 19th century. It's you know, the sort of the man in the street understanding of what science does and what philosophy does. It's really way behind when it, you know, when it comes to what they actually are. I remember when I was testing in for a graduate program, and we got back the results, and it was fun to see, also kind of disturbing, how that, because it was a standard test that all graduate students were taking. I can't remember the name of it, but every discipline took the same test, right? So the two disciplines that came out on top in the humanities, it was philosophy, and in the sciences, it was physics. And the scores were almost identical in terms of, you know, how the students who were applying to get into doctoral programs in these two disciplines scored. The discouraging thing was education was so far back. it was like the rock bottom. These are the people we trust our kids. Anyway, but, you know, I do think that the, you know, sort of the first-rate philosophers and the first-rate physicists I've known dabble in the other side. You know, there's an interest in what's going on the other side of the divide, if we stick to Snow's two cultures.
Yeah.
And partly I think it's because we're dealing with fundamental realities, and there's a sense in which there's just a natural touching at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a philosophy, you know, science is kind of philosophy done by other means sort of thing, yeah. And vice versa. And the kinds of questions that were, that's why, like, when you have someone like, you may have seen this, but, you know, Stephen Hawking saying something like philosophy is dead, and then going on and talking about all this philosophy, and you think, I mean, you just can't escape it. I think, but I think part of that is because people don't understand philosophy, what it is. But I also think there's a lack of understanding, and this is really strange. For actual practicing scientists, sometimes it's just so much, like, there's so much to know that you never have time to think about why, like, what's going on, what are the methods, like, you just kind of, you know, I mean, this is nothing new. This goes all the way back to Kuhn and even
more, but scientific revolution.
But there's certainly this kind of notion where you just kind of catch the method in science, but you don't really think much about how to do it and why are you doing it? It was one of the weird things for me. And I think this is one of the coming into philosophy from a science background. It took me quite a while to figure out, like, I had all these methodological questions.
Okay.
Like, why would you take that as authoritative? You know, it's like, well, you know, what does knowledge mean? And it turns out they're using intuitions about what we would say. Well, would you say that you know, if you accidentally see a clock at the right time and it happens to be, do you know that it's really the right time? You know, I'm thinking, well, that's just about what we're, you know, so there's like this data, and that's just one small example, but there's this methodology that I'm wondering, why are we using that as data? And why are we using that? I think that was really, really helpful for me to have those questions and then to start seeing, okay, I get what they're doing. And then it turns out that the kinds of things they're doing, this is just how people learn things. And so, you know, epistemology, the study of knowledge, and you start, but coming at it from an outsider was so helpful. It was baffling at first, though.
Yeah. Well, I think that, of course, that's kind of the experience that anyone has with a new, you know, body of knowledge.
Yeah, that's right.
But one of the things, too, I think you noted that it's a kind of skill, you know, practice when we think about science. I've heard it described, you know, I think it's Michael Polanyi talks about, you know, science is actually kind of a craft. It's it's not just, you know, well, I don't think it's what some people would have supposed. In other words, you develop certain heuristics, you develop certain abilities to kind of, And then there's even hunches that you have a sense that this is probably where it's, we should go in our thinking and our study. So it's not this abstract,
right,
disembodied thing, right, that I think a lot of folks assume it is.
You know, we had an earlier conversation in which it was mentioned John Milbank has argued that the creation of science as the means of knowledge about the natural world, separating it from natural philosophy, has set back our understanding of the natural world by 300 years.
Hmm.
And I think that there's a lot there. You know, I mean, you know, science is fundamentally an epistemological enterprise. You know, it is a methodology for obtaining knowledge about the physical universe.
Yeah,
okay, great. That's what it is.
Right.
But as soon as you start talking about physics, you're just a half a step away from metaphysics, questions of the ultimate nature of reality. You know, there are so many direct connections between what scientists do, which we think of as having to do with the concrete, the physical world, the, you know, matter and energy and all that, and what philosophers do, which is just thinking about stuff,
right,
that's not really, right, related to the physical world. We've got this fact-value distinction coming out again. We've got that dichotomy in our minds, and it doesn't, if once you start probing it, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, that's why. I think and Chris, like you were saying, like a lot of the philosophers and scientists, you know, that are going back and forth. And I think that would be, you know, if you look at, you know, the famous, there's a debate between Einstein and Niels Bohr about the nature of quantum mechanics. And it, you think, okay, wow, that's, it was all philosophical. Like, nature shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, sure. God doesn't play dice with the universe.
Yeah. Right, so it's right. Like, this was a very important debate that's deciding what direction physics ought to take.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both very self-aware about the philosophical underpinnings that they were, you know, they knew that they were doing philosophy and they knew they were doing physics. And it was, and I think they're one of the, you know, certainly once we get to, you know, after the 30s, you know, after quantum mechanics kind of gets dialed in a little bit, you know, you have World War II, and then everything is very much, this is where logical positivism gets a good, nice, you know, Vienna Circle gets a good foothold, because it's very practical. Like, what can we do with this? Well, yeah, you can win a war with it, you know, that kind of thing. Right, and then next thing you know, you have all these, you know, Lee Smolin, he's a string theorist. He says there were visionaries and then virtuosos, like the mathematical virtuosos, and they split where they kind of weren't split, or they were talking. And then, and there needs to be this, you know, this reconnection, going back to the two cultures again, because it's hurting both. You know, the people who are doing philosophy, if they don't really understand what some of the answers or current answers are for physics, you're going to be out of touch, and vice versa. You're not going to do good physics, unless you're just like, hey, I don't need that for doing an experiment on my workbench. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, fair enough. There are certain things where it's like, just shut up and calculate. You know, that's the kind of thing. Right. But that's not directing physics,
yeah,
in the sense of, hey, should we go with string theory, or are we barking up the wrong tree, and is the scientific method wrong?
Yeah, this, I think, you know, a lot of sort of the grunt work is just sort of filling in the blanks when it comes to a larger architecture of thought. So, you know, a lot of guys,
yeah,
gals out there who are pursuing their studies are just kind of doing the clerk work when it comes, right, to whatever the new endeavor is. Now, do you sense that things are coming back together again? So, like, you know, when you talked about Einstein and Bohr, you know, sometimes people, you know, will pull a statement out of the hat when it comes to, say, Einstein about God or whatever like that. Now, anybody who knows Einstein knows he's, you know, really more in the spirit of Spinoza,
yeah,
when, right, he says that kind of stuff. He's not endorsing biblical religion. But at least those guys were maybe the last days of sort of mainstream classical education. You know, these were guys who were familiar with the trivium and the quadrivium and maybe some of the... Now, they were moving away from some things, but they still had those, those disciplines, you know, kind of drilled into them in Germany or, you know, whatever. What do you think? Is there any hope for bringing things back together? And would it be through the old approach or a new approach? Now, obviously, you're speaking as a professor at a school that advocates classical education.
Yeah.
But
well, Chris, I'm glad you asked that. I was with you. I looking at the broader culture, I do think that there's in academia, there's a growing sense that the siloing of the disciplines needs to be fixed. You know, obviously there's a necessity to like focusing on something because there's so much to learn, but then there's also, you need to have the mixture because they're relevant. And so I do think that there's a growing sense of, and I see this particularly in Christian or religious organizations or people of religion, like science and religion, you know, kind of bringing those two together. And that's kind of this, at least one manifestation of philosophy and, you know, the STEM and the humanities coming together. And I think people are becoming more self-aware. Academia in some circle is becoming more self-aware of this need. And so I think in some cases there are these different, organizations and programs that's what they're funding when it comes to research. Show us how the, you know, science and the humanities connect, and they're funding that kind of research. But I tell you what, we have a long way to go. So there's some hope, but it's like, you know, I think about just where students are coming from generally and we just don't even have a scientific literacy. Well, it's not even just a scientific literacy, because that makes it sound like as if you just took some science courses and learned some terminology that would fix it. That's part of it. But like, here's one problem, one manifestation of the problem, one instance of it. And it doesn't even sound like a problem. I mentioned general relativity and quantum mechanics. And I say, all right, that's it. Conversation's done. But you don't need to know, first of all, those are like the two biggest theories that's what everyone's talking about whenever they talk about physics. It's one of those two related, you know, the telescopes, the particle colliders, whatever. But we tend to think that once you say something like general relativity, You're in this world that is so rarefied. I mean, it's just, but it's not. It's like, you don't need to understand hardly any of the math in order to understand kind of like what the point of it is. Just like you don't need to understand any of the math to know that, oh, wow, I know what Copernicanism is. I know what the Ptolemaic view is. You don't need to do the math to know, to understand at least some of what the point is.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where I think we're right now, we have to fix that. And I think part of it is just, we don't give a big picture of things. We're always, you know, whenever we do math or science, it's like this problem or this topic. Yeah. And it's like, you can't just do that. Like, you can't take a chemistry class and go, okay, guys, what's the difference between chemistry and physics? And you're like, I have no idea. And it's like, well, here's what chemistry is. It's basically the interchange of electrons between atoms. That's it. It's just when someone talks about chemistry, it's just electron. So everything it gives you kind of a big picture. Like, so, and you have to know, to understand what chemistry is, you know, that there are these electrons, then, you know, well, I got to know what an atom is. And then you kind of know what a nucleus is. Then you know that those are made of protons and neutrons, and those are made of quarks. I mean, just like some of the basic things. Sorry, I'm ranting. It's one of those things where I just think it's unnecessarily an easy fix. And it's so, and the stakes are so high.
You know, it's worth noting, and it's something people seem completely unaware of. Einstein actually wrote a book explaining relativity to high school students. And he used illustrations like trains and things like that, where it's just very, very simple to get what he's saying. And yet nobody seems to be aware that he even did that. And nobody, to the best of my knowledge, I've never run into anybody who's ever actually tried to use it to explain it. But that's what Einstein
said. Well, I didn't know it was to high school. I knew it was popular. I didn't know it was even to just high school. So that's even, yeah, no, that's fascinating.
So he was a master of metaphor then. He was taking, things that people don't have direct experience with and relating them to things that they do and saying, there's some resemblance here, guys. You can see this and you can sort of infer certain things about the thing you can't see, which of course is what, analogical language, in theology is all about too. We're not describing God directly, like we've got him under a microscope or something, it's like this or like that, that kind of thing. So maybe there's something to be said just on the other side of this for the education of scientists, in the humanities so that they can relate what they know to a broader audience, as well.
The benefits go both ways. Einstein's an example. Like if he and Bohr couldn't have done what they did without having that philosophical background. And now, and this is one of the diagnoses of kind of the stagnation in physics. I mean, part of the stagnation is because physics is hard and we're bumping up against money and all of this. I mean, it's a big deal, but I think part of it too is just there aren't a lot of those visionaries.
Yeah.
But I think more are starting to come in, but that's actually a big debate on the front lines of physics is, for example, whether beauty should be used as a guide to truth. And then now you're talking about the methodology of physics and whatnot. Sorry, I interrupted you, but
it's really right along the line. I was, wanting to get in, to sort of explore how these two worlds really are not two worlds, but maybe just two approaches to the same world, or sort of what we're talking about is the study of reality, what is real. And at a gut level, everybody sort of in the street would say, well, physical things are real. And then, you get particle physicists who say, well, are you even sure you know what that means? It raises all a range of questions, in the mind. And you get back to, Platonism, which is what's ultimately real, are the forms, out of which everything else in some sense is some manifestation of them, reflection of them, whatever. And then you get into even stuff that's going on today. And I'd like your thoughts on this, because I'm a real nut, I'm a dilettante. I don't know much about these things, but like when I hear about fractals, which apparently is a fairly recent development within mathematics, sort of kind of demonstrating the fractal character of the universe, like a tree in the sense is fractal. You've got the larger structure, then it's mirrored in the branches, then mirrored in the leaves, and it's kind of, and you see that all over the place, and you get, people who are waxing grandiloquent about, chaos theory and stuff like that. And my understanding of chaos theory is that it might be the most inappropriately named thing ever, what they're trying to demonstrate through chaos theory is that it's not as chaotic as you think. There is a structure.
It's very deterministic.
Yeah.
It's just very sensitive.
Yeah. But these are all things that, of course, as a guy on the street, I see these things, I hear about these things, my mind immediately goes to, ultimate reality because of my background in theology and philosophy. But I have lots of fun talking to scientists. I mean, I've got friends who are world-class scientists. I've got a friend who works at the CERN in Switzerland, on the particle accelerator, and he teaches physics in Connecticut at UConn. And I've got another friend down in Huntsville, Alabama, who actually is like a space telescope guy, you know, and he, and I stay at his house sometimes. And when I get into conversations with these guys, it does take us long to get to some places where we're in a complete agreement. Isn't that amazing? I have no idea what's going on. That kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So the wonder element too, to all of this, you know, basically philosophy is a child of wonder, but sciences as well, you know, it's like, wow, what is going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's kind of this is one of the difficulties of the class that I teach. One of the main class, the senior level class, is that it's hard to categorize. Am I teaching math? Is it physics? Is it philosophy? You know, we read Nagel's Mind and Cosmos in this course, and, you know, we talk about aesthetics and we talk about, and ultimately the whole point is we're looking at physics and philosophy and Platonism and all that. But it ends up becoming this notion of, particularly as you start seeing how reason works and the kinds of things that, you know, it's not just an algorithm. You know, we're using inference to the best explanation, and values come in, and they can't help but. And that's Einstein knew that, and that shaped, you know, you think about beauty and how that directs someone. But you can't, you know, it's not an accident that Plato and the Pythagoreans, you got the quadrivium from the Pythagoreans, includes this notion of harmony and music.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's such a, and this is one of the things I think sometimes we don't understand how important music is. You know, I think some communities, I think our community, you know, our school is doing this. We've emphasizing music. And I think that in a way that's important, but I think we still have a long ways to go, because it's something even more substantive about music that's really part of this. I don't even know how to get at, you know, if I were a poet, I could probably explain it, you know, or at least express something of it. But that notion of that meaning, but then you start thinking about going back to Glenn, what you were talking about with the fact value. You really don't have values unless you have valuers. You know, it's not like if you just have like a, you know, a pile of sand, there's no values there. It is like, is that good? Is that bad? Well, sand doesn't, just like it doesn't have love, it doesn't have any values at all. And so you need a valuer. All of a sudden, you're like, very quickly, to have any meaning or value, you have to have some sort of person. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, and this is one of the things that's like, you guys know this better than I do, but ultimate reality is basically this three persons loving one another. You know, I mean, that sounds gushy and mushy and all, and like, no, that's not what I mean, but like, it really is this personhood, meaning are in these relationships between persons. And that's reflected in the way, you know, we're connected to the church, the way we're connected to Jesus and God. I mean, like why we're built to have this relationship. So this fact value, I mean, I get how I can make a distinction between facts and value, but it's all about ultimate meaning and value. And that all comes down to ultimate reality, which is persons. So,
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that the fact-value distinction is artificial. I mean, it has shaped the way the modern world thinks, but that doesn't mean it bears any real resemblance to reality. You know, and I think that's what you're getting at. Before we move on, I want to go back to music for a second. String theory. As I understand it, the way string theory developed is somebody found an equation somewhere in an old manuscript, and they had no idea what it was or what it was for. And then they suddenly discovered it applied to all kinds of areas of physics. But they still didn't know how this guy 300 or 400 years ago came up with it. They then discovered that it was the mathematical description of the vibrations of a string, like on a violin. And then they decided, well, okay, maybe that's why it's called string theory. Maybe the mathematics of a vibrating string is fundamental to the way the universe works. Now, I realize string theory's got its problems, from what I'm told by physicists, but it's another example of the way music just sort of ties into things about reality.
Yeah.
Isn't that one of the things that Pythagoras said? Yeah.
That's one of the things I usually, sometimes I'll just call my class strings to strings, because you have this, you know, when we're talking about the origin of the liberal arts and all of that, you know, the Pythagoreans, they think all is number is because legend says that they looked at the interval, you know, musical intervals of a string and noticed that that's actually remarkably user-friendly. You know, we can assign numbers to those, whole numbers to those. And, you know, so it's all, according to the legend, it just started all from this understanding of vibrating strings. Imagine what they would think now coming back, one of the top contenders for a theory of everything is all the particles and everything are just little versions. This is cosmic symphony of strings.
Yeah. Now we're back to the music of the spheres.
Yeah. And it's like, people will kind of give Kepler a hard time for thinking, oh, well, using the Pythagorean solids or coming up with the music of the spheres and thinking, well, see, he was too into beauty and beauty led him astray. It's like, actually, I mean, the specifics might be wrong, but the notion or the idea is remarkably insightful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's similarly with Plato. You know, it's like we're not studying Plato because we think that everything is made, you know, like we believe everything he said, but he was remarkably insightful.
Right. Right. Now, you mentioned earlier some positive developments. An institution that comes to mind is the Templeton Foundation, who, you know, with the Templeton Prize, and there's an effort on their part to bring these two worlds together. Am I correct remembering that you just got a grant from those guys?
Well, there's two granting bodies for them. There's the John Templeton Foundation and then the Templeton Religion Trust, but they're both from the same Templeton. So there's an overlap. Officially, it's from the Templeton Religion Trust, but that is kind of, you know, part of that.
Do you mind sharing a little bit about what you're going to be working on?
No, I would love to. Anytime I can talk about myself is my favorite topic. This is here's what I'm working on. Well, that's all about me. What do you think about me? The grant is it's this three year project, and I'll be looking at how physicists use beauty as a guide to truth in what they come up with, and it's mostly contemporary physics. I'll obviously have to look at, you know, 19th century, but then particularly talking about 20th century and current, like quantum field theory and whatnot, and how the specific ways that is, you know, it can't be just, it's not just, well, they use beauty. Well, what do you mean by that? So when physicists say they use beauty, what do they mean? Well, sometimes they mean symmetry. Sometimes they mean harmony. Yeah. Sometimes they mean simplicity. And so looking at that and then looking at the mathematical aspects, because a lot of it, like when we say symmetry, we think of, you know, spatial geometrical symmetry, which is great, but theirs is much more abstract and it's kind of hidden in the equations. Yeah. And so you have to look at the mathematics. So all of that is just going to be me fleshing out and researching. So, because that's really on the front line, like I said, on the front lines of physics, that's one of the biggest debates is should beauty be used? You know, Glenn, you talk about that. You were right. Physicists say some physicists say there's problems with string theory because you can't test it. And so you're just having to use these abstract virtues to say, and one of the abstract virtues is, hey, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Yep.
What does that?
I had a roommate who was a high power physicist at Michigan State. He was taking doctoral level physics courses, math courses as an undergrad. Okay, you know, that kind of level. And he used to talk about the importance of elegance in the math.
Yeah.
Is that the same related concept?
Yeah, absolutely. It's elegance. So like, what do they mean by, and that's, so beauty is kind of this catch-all sometimes, but elegance is a type of, well, what do you mean by elegance? And that's a really hard, it's hard to, this is tricky. I mean, it's, I think just aesthetics in general is a lot more difficult subject than we tend to make it. You know, truth, beauty, and goodness. I think the beauty part is really, we're halfway decent on truth and goodness, but I think beauty is one that's really something we need to do more work on. And I think partly that's just, it's interesting and it's fun. But yeah, elegance is one of those.
Well, this brings up a book I read years ago, at least in my mind, The End of Science by John Horgan. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes.
So, you know, with that book, you know, here's a guy who was an editor, a science editor at Scientific America, I think it was. And he was frustrated because he thought science was leaving, its own methods behind and becoming kind of postmodern in its approach.
Right.
But he also said, you know, if I recall correctly, we're losing an ability to measure things so that we can, you know, demonstrate our theories because we're dealing with things that are at the extreme limits of our tools. And, you know, we're only going to be able to progress scientifically as our tools become more refined and able to discern things that we can't discern just with our physical senses. That struck me as being one of those things where, I think that's right. But at the same time, for one thing, you know, we were pretty creative at developing tools for measuring things, you know, like we can actually measure gravity waves now. You know, that's pretty amazing.
But at
the same time, I mean, theoretically, yes. I mean, there's got to be a limit. I mean, there's got to be a point at which, you know, we just can't see farther. It may just come down to we don't have the money. You know, it's just, you think about like the particle accelerator, you know, that's a pretty expensive thing to develop. And so, but does that mean that we are falling into this just sort of like world of kind of crazy theorizing? Or do we actually have an ability to make good judgments about things that are beyond our ability to measure? And maybe aesthetics is the way to that.
Right. Yeah. And well, that is the question. That's the debate. The debate is, you know, that you set it up just perfectly, described it perfectly. We don't currently have the ability to get data beyond, you know, we're kind of limited there. So we don't have any new observations really. I mean, we do, but, and so you have to progress some other way. Well, maybe beauty's that way because it's worked in the past for things. But then people say, well, look at Kepler. It didn't work there, but it worked. So the debate now is whether or not that's legitimate. Someone like Einstein would be like, absolutely. Like he'd rather, you know, that's why he was so successful. And some people think, yeah, Einstein ruined us.
Oh, interesting.
You know, like he gave us this desire. He was able to do this, and now we think we can all do it. I mean, even Einstein, they say, couldn't do it after Einstein. Yeah. You know, like when he tried to have later in his life, he couldn't. Einstein was no Einstein, you know. And so that's the sweet spot right there. What's the answer to that? And that's what I'm working on.
Yeah. Mitch, a couple of thoughts that occur to me, and I've never really talked about these or try to express them before, but I think there's a
connection. This is a safe space. So,
first of all, with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you know, people act as if that's a limitation on God. Even God himself can't know that, you know, can't know both where something is and where it's going. And I think the response to that, and actually to some of the points you brought up earlier, is that the nature of God's knowledge is not is different. It is a totally different form of knowledge than what we do, and thus there are no limits on it that are the limits on the kind of knowledge we have. I mean, I think that that's a basic theological point. I think, by the way, it also helps answer the question, how can he listen to everybody's prayers at once, that you raised earlier. But I think this may also be connected to something else, and that's the question of whether not just our tools, but our mathematics and our way of understanding things can even apply at the subatomic level. When we're dealing with these levels of quantum stuff that seems so utterly bizarre to us, it strikes me that it's at least a possibility that our minds are not structured in a way that will actually give us the kind of understanding of that that we can in the experiential world we live in, you know, day by day. And that may apply at the other end as well to the weirdnesses we're seeing through through the space telescopes.
Absolutely. I think that's a concern. I mean, even I think physicists think this too. You know, I mean, it could be just that we're getting to, I mean, not necessarily that we're getting to the limits, but there are just things that we're, our cognitive faculties and the way we are made and hardwired and the way we know is just ill-suited for understanding, you know, what actually is going on.
Yeah.
Ultimately. And there's a, you know, there's a view that just, you know, it's just, it's called it. And you, I'm sure you know about it, like instrumentalism, where it's just kind of this, the math is an instrument to describe the observables and that, but it's not really telling us the truth about what's going on. And that was a big debate between Einstein and Bohr. You know, Bohr's like, there is no quantum world. You know, Einstein's like, come on, man, there's that means that quantum mechanics is wrong. So I think, we should always have that possibility that we're just, ultimately, we just can't in this form cognitively grasp.
Yeah, this is probably a good place to wrap it up because we are getting to the time limit here. But anyway, so basically, we've come to this point where we're saying, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we don't know.
Which I think we could all sign there. I'm glad we got that settled.
Well, Mitch, is there anything that you want to say about, you know, how people can follow your work? I mean, particularly the work you're doing now on this question of, you know, the relationship between aesthetics and scientific research. Will there be like a blog that you keep? Is there anything like that?
Yeah. Well, right now, nothing like a blog. There'll be eventually. This should become a book. I mean, that's one of the things that's part of the project is a book manuscript that comes out of it. And then in the meantime, there'll be journal articles and talks that I'll be giving. And I've talked about some of this stuff. They're on given talks that are online, you know, about the connection between science and religion and science and humanities and beauty and whatnot. That's what's coming in the future.
Is there do you have like an author website or anything?
I do have a website, MitchStokes.com. It's not kept up.
Join the club. Mine isn't either.
Yeah, mine neither.
Anyway, well, why don't we just encourage folks to check out your books and to, you know, you just go on to, you know, Amazon or wherever, and you can find Mitch's stuff. You know, it's readily available, some of the stuff he's written in the past. And then hopefully we'll be able to maybe get you back on when you've had a chance to make a little progress and maybe written some papers and stuff. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening to the Theology Podcast. We're glad that you've made it to the end of the show. And as your reward, you get to hear about Patreon. So we have bills, as everyone does. And in order to pay to have this show produced and posted, we've got different people we have to pay. And when you help us out at Patreon, it helps us to make sure that those people get paid. And I know they appreciate it. But anyway, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Theology Podcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. If you liked this podcast, you might enjoy another one of our podcasts, Got a Minute, featuring Larson Hicks and Rich Lusk, theology, philosophy, economics, politics, and more for normal people.